On today's episode, Tape 8, Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys and Song Cycle by Van Dyke Parks.
Trust the Wizards present Robert Pollard's Guide to the Late 60s. Before going on tour with his band, Guided by Voices, in 2001, Robert Pollard recorded his favourite records onto 62 double-sided cassettes. Music from 1966 to 1971, from the best-known bands of the era to obscure, unheard-of psychedelic curios. The Wizards are on a mission to listen to and explore every groove. Kicker and Chorizo invite you to turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream as you listen to Robert Pollard's Guide to the Late 60s.
Today we're talking about two albums very much from California. First of all, we're going to talk about the very well-known album Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, which was recorded in early 1966. And released later on in 1966, and in 1967, and came out in December 1967, is the album Song Cycle by Van Dyke Parks, who by that point was collaborating quite a lot with the Beach Boys, but not that was on their next album and not on Pet Sounds. As I'm sure people are aware, a very highly regarded album. For example, The Rolling Stone magazine, their 500 greatest albums of all time, which they did in 2003. It was second in number two in that. Sgt. Pepper was number one. And they did it again in 2020. And Pet Sounds was still second. But this time there was a new number one, which was What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. So many people's favourite album of all time. Yeah, it was written by Brian Wilson. The music was written by Brian Wilson, and kind of the other Beach Boys went off on tour in early 1966 and came back to find that he'd kind of written most of this music, along with a guy who wrote most of the lyrics, was called something Asher. I forgot what his first name is. It was quite a departure from what the Beach Boys had done and had been very successful with earlier on, with that kind of surfing, quite polished beat group with doo-wop type harmonies on it, which I have to say I'm not much of a fan of. I find that to be sort of, you know, it's Chuck Berry, it's 50s rock and roll with all the rough edges smoothed off, and it's put me off the Beach Boys for many, many years, all that squeaky clean striped shirt surfboard rubbish. Are you a fan of that early stuff, Kicker?
Not really. I like the Ventures. Yeah. I think they're a little bit more interesting. It's interesting to say the stripy shirts, though, because I was looking on my copy of Pet Sounds, which is on vinyl, which I think my version came out probably 70-something. I think it's not an original release. But on the back, they are all dressed in their striped shirts, albeit black and white photographs. I was looking for the, what's his name, Asher, and he's not mentioned on the back of this, so I don't know who that is.
Well, I'll look it up in a minute, because it's mentioned in this booklet. I've got this, it's not mine, it belongs to my wife, but I've got this Beach Boys Pet Sounds Sessions 4-CD box set, which came out in the mid-90s. I think it was around about the 30th anniversary of the album. It's got four discs. This one, which is just the straightforward mono mix of the album. And then there's three more discs here with a newly produced stereo mix that was produced for this box set. Loads and loads and loads of outtakes, alternative versions, and versions. There's instrumental versions and versions which is just the vocals without the backing tracks. Got to say, I haven't really listened to that very much. I've just been listening to the original mono album.
Had you had to listen to this album before? I mean, is it something that you've come to fairly fresh, or is it something that you know very well?
A little bit of both, actually. I definitely heard this album when I worked at HMV as a teenager, like I did with a lot of this album music from the 60s. I first heard it when I was a teenager, first left school. Already had some prejudices against the Beach Boys because of that striped shirt, silly doo-wop nonsense. Some of the older people that I worked with in the shop were telling me that it was one of the greatest albums ever made. They put it on. Mm. I thought it was all right. I remember being pleasantly surprised that it was quite different to what I expected. Mm. But some of the songs I liked, but most of them passed me by a bit. But then in the 1990s, I have to give a big thank you to three of my friends, Simon, Jimmy and Paul. Thank you very much to them. They're all good friends of mine that I knew when I moved to London, and ex-band mates of mine. And all three of them are absolute Beach Boys fanatics. And I've been talking to all three of them this week to get some more background on them. So I've definitely, when I used to hang around with them, I've definitely been in the room when they've put on Pet Sounds. And again, I quite liked it. As I said, my wife is a big fan. I've been along because of them. I mean, to give you an indication of how big of Beach Boys fans some of those people are, two of them met at an audition where they were auditioning to be in the band for a planned Beach Boys stage musical, which never actually happened. And then I think I've actually been on stage, weirdly, even though I'm not much of a Beach Boys fan. In 98, when Carl Wilson died, those fellas organised, along with some various other Beach Boys super fans, organised a memorial concert for Carl Wilson, which took place in Kensington. And there was sort of a Beach Boys super group. And I believe that made history because it was the first time Beach Boys songs had ever been played live with an actual live theremin. I went to that to watch my friends in it. And I'm pretty sure, at one point, I ended up on stage singing backing vocals, even though I don't really know the Beach Boys stuff that well. But I'm pretty sure I ended up singing on Sloop John B.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the theremin, because one of the things that I noticed, I don't know this album very well. I think I came to it in the same sort of prejudice that you did. I thought they were sort of a band that my mother might like, so I therefore didn't like them. But it has been really interesting listening to this again quite closely, and I'll give you my big take in a sec. But what I did note down is that the song "I Just Wasn't Made for These Times" seemingly was the first time the theremin was used on a rock record.
That's right. Yeah, and not "Good Vibrations," which was recorded around about the same time, but
didn't come out.
Yeah, it didn't come out with the album.
By the way, it's Tony Asher.
Tony Asher, thank you very much. And he was a guy who, I think he's a Brit, and he was over there working in advertising, and he met Brian and wrote all these lyrics, which, you know, I think it has to be said that the lyrics definitely help in conveying this sense of sort of alienation and loneliness that I find is present throughout the whole album. It's quite a sad, melancholy album. A lot of that comes from the lyrics.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it definitely has a melancholy feel. The lyrics do nothing for me, frankly. And I think I would like this album a lot more if it was just instrumental. Because I think the instrumentation is the really interesting bit.
Yeah.
And my thing that I really noticed listening to it carefully and listening to it more than once in a blue moon was the percussion. The percussion is fantastic. There's so many interesting sounds on it, and actually it's the lyrics which have a tendency to be soppy, would that be fair, tend to put me off really, but the sounds on it, even like a song like "You Still Believe in Me," which, you know, is all right, but there's a bicycle bell at the end of it, which is brilliant.
Well, the session musicians are all the kind of the Californian go-to guys who would have played on all the big Phil Spector records of the time, and all the TV themes. It's the Wrecking Crew, so it's, you know, Hal Blaine on drums and Larry Nechtel on organ, and Kay and Glenn Campbell's playing on it, and, you know, all those big names, Tommy Tedesco.
Who's on drums? Because the drumming is brilliant.
It's mainly Hal Blaine. Mainly Hal Blaine.
Ah.
And he's like, you name it, from the 60s, he played on it. You know, he played, I think...
That's the same with the drums at the beginning, right at the beginning of Wouldn't It Be Nice. I mean, that is the sound. You think, wow, that's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah. And then it's a song that sounds like it's been written by some sort of lovelorn sixth former.
But, yeah, well,
you know, nevertheless.
I'm not a fan of the lyrics of that one, really. And I find that a bit squeaky clean lyrically. It's not my favourite on the album. I've got my keyboard over there. Because what I've done this week, as well as listening to the album, what I've done is I've actually tried to understand the music, and I've like been trying to learn some of the songs, and there's some interesting stuff going on musically. So seeing as we're talking about Wouldn't It Be Nice, I'll start with that one, right? So what's unusual? We talked about this a little bit in the episode about the Who Sell Out, which was about, a song that establishes what key you're in, so you kind of feel you're on solid ground. But what it does on that one is kind of like, it starts off in A, and it plays like, can you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. So he does this. So what would make sense if you're in the key of A would be to go... Be nice, and stay in A. That's what the normal thing you would do. But for some reason, the intro is in A. Do, 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 do. Wouldn't it be nice? It just goes then straight to F, which is, I mean, F isn't even in the key of A. It's a very bizarre thing to do. And then at the start of God Only Knows, it starts with this AE thing. I'll play you that as well. Da, da, da. What's the point of that? Da, 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 da. If you're going to do a song where it's in D, when the singing comes in, then do the intro in D.
What is the point of that, then?
Well, I just think, because you can.
Mm.
Because you don't have to play it live. One of the reasons why you do the intro in the same key as when the vocals come in is because it gives the vocalist a cue of what their starting note is. I guess if he's not worried about playing it live and he's just thinking this is a studio album, then he can...
Mm.
He could do that. Other things going on with the chords of it. I've been messing around with... there's a lot of chords where the root note is not... Where the bass note is not in the chord. There's also a lot of where the bass note is the third or the fifth of the chord, but also lots where it's, for example, a C with... or a B flat with a C in the bass. And it's all very unusual harmonically... Definitely a big step away from Fun, 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 Till Daddy Takes the T-Bird Away. All those songs which are mainly three or four chords. And when I see that being done in the 1960s and I think, well, who else was doing that kind of thing at the same time? And it's just Burt Bacharach is the only person I know who writes songs which are that harmonically complex and yet sound like total pop songs.
See, this is very interesting because I've often thought, why seen in such high, you know, standing and you know it's basically the, as you said, it's described as a masterpiece and the most influential album in musical history and all this sort of stuff, and you know it's not an album that I would ever choose to put on.
Yeah,
not an album that, you know, spoiler alert, I particularly like. But I think the reason it gets to the top of all these lists is that it's really a musician's record. So if you are a musician and you're really interested in songwriting and the technicalities of it, because of all this unusual instrumentation and unusual time signatures and unusual key changes, if you analyse it like that, I would imagine that it's fascinating. But actually, as a record... It's okay.
Well,
it's not unpleasant. Absolutely not unpleasant. But as a listening experience, I mean, it was described. So I found a quote about it which I quite like. It said, "There's not much rocking and even less rolling." And I can't remember who said that. But yeah, right. So it's nice.
All of that is true. But if you took a lot of those things you said about how it being, yes, there's a lot of key changes. Yes, there's sometimes, I don't know if there's much time signature changing, but, and there's a lot of fancy chords. But the second album we're going to talk about today also has that.
Yeah.
But What the difference is, this thing has cohesion. It stands together, and it still manages to have songs that you can sing along with, and memorable hook lines and melodies, and the top line is great.
So is that the genius then? The genius is to do all that interesting stuff and still make it pop.
I'm not saying that Brian Wilson is a genius, but I mean, what I am saying is that he's on this album is a big step forward in his kind of compositional skills. As a writer of music, it's quite developed, and it's quite interesting. It's certainly influential. A lot of bands that came since, as well as the Beatles, Paul McCartney, who was a massive fan of this album, and it advanced his bass playing, and certainly his songwriting, arguably was advanced by some of this. But all that kind of type of music, I know it's not particularly a type of music you like, and I'm not sure I like much of it either, but a lot of that music in the 70s and 80s that's quite sophisticated, so I'm thinking like Steely Dan, would there be any Steely Dan without the Pet Shop, but without the Pet Sounds? All those kind of very well produced, slightly jazz influenced records of the 80s with your Prefab Sprouts, your Aztec Cameras, your Squitty Pilates, all those kind of bands. Again, I know that isn't particularly music you like, but they were definitely listening to Pet Sounds, I think, and taking a few tips.
See, the thing is, from my side, is that if you're going to put words on it, the words are going to be interesting, and they're not. So I accept that there is a lot of very clever, very, use your words, sophisticated songwriting going on in terms of the structure of the songs and the musicality and all that. But frankly, the words, I'm going to be shot down for this, but God only knows, which is often held up as being the greatest song ever.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, to me, it sounds like, if you look at the words of that song, it seems to me that it's a virgin writing about sex. and it's that level of, what? Oh, come on. Come on. And that is throughout the album. It's just so twee and soppy. And take that all out. I reckon I'd really like it. I'd really like this album if it was instrumental. I'm pretty much sure of that.
Right.
But the words just do my head in.
Yeah, right. I don't know about the words for God Only Knows, but I think some of the other words, what I was saying before about them coming across as this kind of alienation, loneliness, the feeling that you don't belong, that you weren't made for these times. That's definitely true in the words of I Know There's an Answer. Probably in here today, it makes you feel so sad, it makes your heart feel bad, makes your days go wrong, makes your nights so long, all that stuff.
I mean, come on, just listen back to what you've just read out, honestly.
Yeah, I know, but I could easily point to singers and songwriters who you like who are just as guilty of indulgent, self-pitying lyrics.
Well, luckily, we're not talking about them.
Yes, okay. I don't think the lyrics are dread. I'd much rather listen to lyrics like this with music that feels slightly melancholy and words that correspond with that than I would to listen to songs about, you know, let's put the surfboard on the car and get in the T-Bird and, you know, and go down to, you know, Wakanama Beach or whatever.
I accept that, and I think the lyrics throughout their body of work, you're probably going to, I would say, I'm not going to really do it for me. But okay, let's talk about some of the highlights then. So where are the highlights for you on this album?
Probably my favourite song on the whole thing is probably Don't Talk, Put Your Head on My Shoulder.
Oh, God.
which is, I really like the organ of that, and I just really like the melody. It's very, very catchy. The only song I particularly dislike is Sloop John B. I could quite easily never listen to that song again as long as I live. I like Caroline No a lot. Do we have to choose three? I'll choose Don't Talk, Put Your Head on My Shoulder. Definitely, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. And probably I Know There's an Answer. But interestingly, all the people I've spoken to, including my wife, They all said that when asked to pick their favourite songs, not necessarily their favourite, but amongst their favourites, God Only Knows always featuring. I quite like God Only Knows. Yeah, I know the lyrics may not be great, but it's a good song. But it's not my favourite. If you'd asked me before this last couple of weeks when I've been listening to this album, how much do I like this album, I would have given it a much lower score. It's gone up a lot in the last couple of weeks because I forgot about some of the songs on it. I just totally forgot about That's Not Me. I totally forgot about I'm Waiting for the Day. And I totally forgot, I particularly forgot about I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, which I used to like a lot, and I just completely forgot that it existed.
Well, I mean, Sleep John B is an interesting one, isn't it? Because the little bit of research that I did, I don't think Brian Wilson's on it. And it's it was written as a hit single, wasn't it? And shoved on the album, so it kind of doesn't fit. See, I don't mind that song.
Right.
I think it's all right. I think it's a decent enough song. The one I really like is I Know There's an Answer, which when I listen to that, I'm singing Hang On to Your Ego
instead of I Know There's an Answer. Because that was the original words.
And Frank Black did a cover. That's right. Which is great.
Yeah. The one of the things that happened is Mike Love didn't like the fact that the lyrics were "Hang on to your ego," and he thought it was too druggy. He was always quite against Brian putting in too many references to, you know, the drug experience, the LSD experience, into his lyrics. So he got him to change. Or maybe Tony Asher got them to change the lyrics. So originally it was "Hang on to your ego," and then they changed it. But yeah, I like that one a lot.
I like that one. I like the harmonica solo on it, and there's something on it that sounds like a kazoo, which I don't know if it is a kazoo, but I don't know what it is. Hang which on. I really like.
I can tell you while I'm looking at. I'll look it up for you in this very comprehensive booklet. There's a bass harmonica, something that sounds like a kazoo. Well, there's drums, tambourine, bass, guitar, piano, organ, must be the organ, I guess, saxophones.
Saxophones, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Caroline No as well, because the other thing I found out about that was that lyric changed as well.
Right.
From Caroline No, because originally the song was Carol, I Know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's dog barks at the end of that, which I like.
The actual pet sounds.
But not the sound of a horse. There's a dog barking at the end of Caroline No.
Yes. The pet sounds.
But no horses, and because didn't he famously bring a horse to want to bring a horse into the studio?
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. Sounds like the kind of thing that might have happened on the next album we're going to talk about. I think all those anecdotes of the really crazy behaviour in the studio, I think that's mainly on the next album, but I don't know. Just to correct you on something you said before, because I've got this booklet, the lead vocal on Sloop John B is Brian and also Mike Love.
Oh, well, there you go. All right. Okay. So my top three songs, I know there's an answer, which is actually a song I really like, so fair play. There's a song on this album I really like. Sloop John B, he's all right. And then the instrumentals I like, so Pet Sounds and Let's Go Away for a While, that would be up there for me as well. The rest of it is just a bit too twee. But it, in the same way as you said that your score for this has gone up over the last couple of weeks, having listened to it, which makes sense, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
I would say mine has too. And I'm particularly keen on the percussion on this, which I think has given it an extra point.
Okay, shall we do the points for this album now then, before we go on to the other one?
Yeah, go on then. What do you give it?
I think, like I said before, before this week, I'd have probably said it was a 5 or a 6. But I'm going to upgrade it I gave Sgt. Pepper an 8, and I can't say it's quite in the same bracket for me as Sgt. Pepper, but I'll give it a 7.5. Because I've liked it a lot, and I will listen to it more.
Well, there you go. Well, I'm very glad that you've had a nice time listening to it. I think I would have given it probably a 4 before I started listening to it properly, but I'm going to give it a 5.5.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, let's go on to Song Cycle, then, by Van Dyke Parks.
Oh, yeah, now we're talking, right? Now we're talking.
This is a difficult album, isn't it? It's restless. I mean, for those who've never heard it, which I imagine is quite a lot of people out there, it kind of jumps around from one style to another very, very quickly, in a lot of cases. And I think it's attempting to be a kind of the story of America in the 1960s, and it's kind of all sounds a bit fractured, but it's got bits of lots of different styles of music which are very American, like bits of ragtime, bits of honky tonk piano, bits of country, bits of show tunes, bits of bluegrass music, bits of all kinds of different things on it. Very often in the same song. If you can call them songs.
Well, I don't think you can call them songs. I think that is a misnomer. I think that the fact that it's called Song Cycle is taking the mickey, really, because there aren't any songs on it. apparently, the original title for it was Looney Tunes.
Right.
And I think that's better, because they are tunes, not necessarily tuneful, but they are tunes.
Yes.
And it is put together by a lunatic. I mean, it really is. So this is this Van Dyke Parks who comes onto the scene, really, with the Beach Boys. Kind of, there's a missing bit here, because this is, we're talking about this now because Robert Pollard put it on the same tape as Pet Sounds. But actually, the Pet Shop Boys, I'm going to call them that again. The Pet Sounds album was followed by what was going to be Smile. And that's where Van Dyke Parks comes in, really, isn't it? And we'll talk about that on the annex one, because that's when we're going to look at Smile.
Yeah.
But that's the link. But actually, this guy, what is he doing, honestly? I don't know.
It says that I got this piece from Uncut Magazine here from a few years ago. And it basically, this is Van Dyke Parks talking. So it was at the age of 24, all I had was a contract at a record company. And why did I get that contract? Well, obviously not because of my voice. It was because I knew Brian Wilson, and the big wigs at Warner Brothers wanted to know what Brian Wilson knew. I'll skip a bit there. What you find in Song Cycle is a confessional on my absolute obsession with what the studio could do. I went into that with a youthful excess. I view Song Cycle as a way in which I could make all the mistakes I could make at one time. But I think it represents an absolute achievement because I learned how to use the studio, and I quickly brought that learning to other projects. He also says it's not song-driven, so it's easy prey for people who were afraid of it. Now, because all I know about Van Dyke Parks...
Well, that's gaslighting. That's gaslighting me, isn't it? That, but saying you only don't like it because I'm afraid. No. I don't like it because it's horrendous. I mean, actually, when I first heard this album, I thought it was utterly, utterly awful.
Yeah.
But actually, on repeated listens, and I have given it repeated listens, it does start to make sense a little bit. It really does.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to get... It's almost... I remember the first time, an album we're going to talk about probably in about 3 years' time, the rate we're doing these shows, but talk about Beefheart's...
Trapmark Respector?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not an easy album to get into.
No.
But it's nothing like this. But I think the problem with this is it's difficult, and it's also the sort of the music types that he's messing around with aren't actually music types that I particularly like either.
I think that
makes it much harder.
That's the problem, whereas the Trout Mask Replica is mainly messing around with sort of styles of music that we like and enjoy. That's not to mean spoiler for when we get round to it, but that's not to say that I think Trout March Replica is any kind of we'll do that when we get round to it. I found a tweet that I enjoyed from someone who's Thoya Deal BH Behaig. It was about this album, and it this kind of sums it up to me in many ways. It said, though it was misunderstood at the time of release, Van Dyke Parks' Song Cycle is now widely recognised as an unlistenable piece of shit. which kind of sums it up for me. I think exactly what you said there. I mean, I don't particularly like honky-tonk piano. I don't particularly like big dramatic show tunes. And that's the kind of music that he's messing up with. I do actually like, so country music and bluegrass, but there's never enough of it. And I also quite like quite a lot of avant-garde classical music. But there are sometimes bits of this that I like. And I think, oh, this bit's all right. And then 20 seconds later, it's disappeared and it's gone into something different.
Is he deliberately taking the piss? I mean, it sounds like it to me. This is not a serious record. Although it's kind of serious musicality, I suppose, and messing around and cleverness on one level. It's really not serious at all. I don't think anyone who put this together really wanted to people to say, oh, that's an album I want to listen to again. Let's put that on. I don't think there's any of that going on. It's just, as he said, it's experimental. Well, and it's trying out things in the studio.
Yes. And I think in terms of him, that's what he wanted to do, was go into a studio, mess about, see what was possible. Because before, I didn't really know about his Beach Boys connections, but I do know that Van Dyke Parks is a name I know from reading various books about Phil Oakes over the years. And he produced Phil Oakes' Greatest Hits, which isn't a Greatest Hits, it's just a normal album. And I think he was involved with the string arrangements on a couple of the A&M albums that Phil Oakes made before then. And the string arrangements on there are amazing. They're really, really good. So he does know how to arrange music, but his voice isn't great. He says in the same interview I quoted from before, he says he found himself not being legitimate enough for highbrow music and being too musically obsessed to be branded as lowbrow. So I find myself on the borderline between those two opposing forces. So I don't know if he was deliberately trying to take the piss when he did it, but I think he was trying to make some points. In the lyrics about America generally, or about the Cold War, I kind of sense that he's trying to say something. He's trying to make some kind of political statement. It's just not that clear what that is.
If that's what he's doing, I've missed it. The thing that I like, and there is something I like about it, and the thing I've got this album on vinyl, and I have to say it hasn't been played very much. But the best thing about it is that the final song on side one is entitled Van Dyke Parks.
Yeah.
This is noted as public domain. Because actually what it is, it's not a song about Van Dyke Parks, it's Nearer My God to Thee, right?
Yeah.
Which is in the public domain. So he's got the song Van Dyke Parks by public domain, and then the first song on side two is called Public Domain, and the songwriter is Van Dyke Parks.
Yes.
And that joke right there is the best bit of this album.
Right.
And you don't actually have to take the record out of the sleeve to get the joke.
Might be better if you don't take the record out of the sleeve.
But the other thing about that Van Dyke Parks song, so Nearer My God to Thee, it's the sound of that being sung, right?
Yeah.
That hymn being sung with running water, right? Am I doing it justice?
And also there's a noise that sounds like a sort of boat funnel or maybe some kind of train engine on it as well.
And I thought, well, that's just a bit daft, isn't it? But I've done a bit of research, and actually, this is another joke,
right.
And it's quite good, because "Nearer My God to Thee" was seemingly the last song played by the band or the orchestra or whatever on the Titanic.
Right. Okay. I'm already laughing.
Yeah. So there you go. So that's pretty clever, isn't it?
So it's kind of an oral collage of what it might have sounded like when the Titanic went down.
Yes, and isn't that a review of this album?
Yeah, I mean, I've written down sound collage in my notes for this album, and I kind of think in some ways a sound collage album, you know, a bit like Revolution Number 9 on the White Album, that might have been more interesting than attempting to make songs out of it, because some of the songs are very irritating, very, very irritating.
Go on, which ones did you really dislike the most?
I particularly, well, There's quite a few songs where I quite like the first 25 seconds or so.
Yes, there's
one called The Old Golden, and the first 25 seconds is like harps and other weird sounds that they're kind of going in and out of phase of each other, a bit like sort of...
Well, I can tell you, that's a farkle.
What, and what is that then?
I don't know, but apparently a farkle, there's a farkle effect being used on those instruments to make it sound like that. I agree, that's good.
But then the actual song starts, and it's some kind of really stupid show tune, very, very irritating, with really rubbish...
It's going back to the country.
Yeah, it's really... Even you saying that line has reminded me of that little bit of the song and how much I dislike it. And the really rubbish honky-tonk piano. Yeah, I didn't like that at all. And then the song you've already mentioned, Public Domain, again, it starts off quite nice. It's got harps and acoustic guitars. And the instrumental parts are really good. And then there's these kind of dramatic Hollywood film score strings, quite dramatic, quite romantic. And then the singing comes in and totally spoils it again. The only things I can say in its defence are that there are some quite clever wordplay lyrics around in the second to last song by the People. Again, it's something to do with the Civil War or slavery or something. The lyrics are too obtuse for me to really understand, but there's stuff about red, white and blue, there's stuff about Strike Up the Band, the Forgotten South, Tar Babies, Cotton Mouths. There's a bit where he kind of paraphrases something about darkies, and you know, it's definitely trying to say something. I'm just not exactly sure what that is. And then the last song, Potpourri, which is not very good, but the lyrics are again, it's trying to say something about World War II. It's got it says I can read the whole lyrics to you because it's not very long. A southwester in the yard invested with the garden and camped in concentration. Well, camped in concentration. I feel like Ted Rogers doing the clues at the end of Dusty Bin, you know. Camped in concentration. Well, that's obviously a reference to the concentration camps. Of a tall lilac to peel the rust off the purple arbour. Time is not the main fort. From under the rain wrought, from roots that bought us coots to hoot and haul us all back to the prime ordeal. Dust off Pearl Harbour time. So he's got the purple arbour, which is like a gardening thing, isn't it? An arbour. And then Pearl Harbour, which...
Very good.
So there's some clever wordplay in there.
But actually, you're missing the point about this song. The reason this song is not as annoying as so many of the others is the fact that the vocals mixed so far down in the sound that you can hardly hear it. And I think the fact that those lyrics are there at all is fine, but the fact that you can't really hear the singing because it's badly mixed or mixed in a way that you can't, it doesn't come into prominence. I think the fact that it's still annoying, his voice is still annoying, even though you can barely hear it, is quite telling.
He hasn't got a very nice singing voice, has he? That's a big problem.
Because frankly, the only song that I could say I like, would be the song that's entitled Donovan's Colours, which is an instrumental version of Donovan's Colours.
Yes. Yeah.
And I like the glockenspiel on that. I assume it's glockenspiel.
I think it's a xylophone. But I really like the song Colours by Donovan, the normal version. And yes, I quite like this until the xylophone came in, because the xylophone's bloody relentless. And it skits about all over the place. And then that bloody honky-tonk piano comes in again, and it goes all ragtime. But, yeah, you would think it would be... On one level, you'd think it'd be hard to mess up an instrumental cover of a Donovan's Colours. But he does. It starts off all right, and then he just tries to get too clever with it.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting noise at the beginning of that. I can't remember what that noise was, but I've noted that down as interesting noises at start. I've written down, so there you go. I quite like that bit. But yeah, no, I've struggled with it.
What I will say about it is, having learnt that Van Dyke Parks wrote the lyrics for Brian Wilson's music for an album that was considered not a good career move for the Beach Boys. and was ended up not being released. I am actually quite excited about hearing that now, because I do think Van Dyke Parks, he's got something in his lyrics.
Yeah.
He's got a talent there.
Well, I think that's true. I think, and you know, that was one of my major criticisms of Pet Sounds was that the lyrics are a bit twee. There's nothing twee about the lyrics in this. I mean, no. They're impenetrable half the time, but they're not twee.
But it's the music that's not. I mean, I don't know if twee is the right kind of. It's just annoying.
Yeah,
anyway, should we do? I don't really have anything to say about favourite songs on this album, other than the song Up Laurel Canyon. Is it called on Inside One?
Laurel Canyon Boulevard. The two songs.
Yeah, I think that's only about 30 seconds long. So by default, that makes it my favourite song.
Oh, but it comes back again. Comes back again on the second side.
Yeah, but the first part of it's only 30 seconds long, so that is my favourite.
The second part's actually got some quite amusing, silly voices. I'm surprised you didn't like that. But yeah.
Well,
yeah,
after how much I like that Beatles song, You Like My Name, Look Up the Number with the stupid voices. She's like the worst thing I've ever heard.
I think basically we're not clever enough to understand this album. And what was it Van Dyke Park said? We're too scared to like it. Is that what it is?
You said you've gone back and listened to it. You didn't like it the first time you listened to it. And I thought, well, I don't like this at all. I really don't like it. And what's more, I don't get it. I don't get what it's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I have been back and I've listened to it probably about 6 or 7 times all the way through. Yeah. Thinking, well, maybe it's a grower.
Mm.
I think it's a shrinker.
Well,
I've liked it less the more I've listened to it. And I really didn't like it the first time.
It's the music version of jumping into an ice cold bath.
Yes,
there's a lot of shrinkage going on. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I had a really kind of strange experience with this because I first heard it and I really didn't like it at all, at all. And then I still didn't like it second, third listen. And about the fourth listen, I thought, actually, this isn't as terrible as I think it is. I think maybe I'm in. Maybe I've got it. And then by the time that it's sort of 6, 7, 8 times I've listened to it, no, I've gone past that. Actually, it's shit.
So maybe the sweet spot was around about the fourth or fifth listen.
Yes, that would be my advice, is listen to it 4 times and then never listen to it again.
I'm past that point. I've listened to it more than that. And I can confidently say I will never listen to this again. Shall I give you my marks out of 10?
Please do.
Well, do you remember when we did Tommy and I said, I don't want to give it 10. Because I want to have somewhere to go if there's something I like more than this.
Yeah.
Well, for that reason, I don't want to score it too low.
No.
Because
Who knows what's to come?
We've got a lot more albums to listen to. And I strongly suspect there will be some stuff I dislike more than this. I can see the merit in it.
Yeah.
And I can see that there's something there. So I'm not going to give it a 0 because for some of the lyrics, and I can see that it's innovative. He is trying to be innovative, and hats off to him for that.
And actually, can I just say, he's a good looking fella on the front cover. You know, he looks like a nice lad.
Okay, well, I haven't seen the front cover, so I can't comment on that. But yeah, so for some of the lyrics and for the being innovative, and occasionally there are some quite nice sections of music, which unfortunately. Usually quite brief, because then they'll be interrupted by something weird and bizarre that I don't like. But I'm going to give it 3, I think. 3
out of 10. Are you giving it 3? Okay. Yeah. Well, I was umming and ahhing about how low to go. But I've got a bit of a heads up on you, because I have listened to everything that we're going to listen to.
Mm.
So without giving too much away, I think I need somewhere to go down.
Right. Okay.
So I wrote down 3 as well, so I'm going to give it 3.
All right then, so next time we meet, we will be going back into the Beach Boys for this.
Yeah. Well, it's actually the combination of the Beach Boys and Van Dyke Parks.
I mean, indeed. Well, so long as Van Dyke Parks isn't singing or editing, we should be better than this. Maybe it will combine the best bits.
The Smile Sessions. And actually, there's obviously hundreds of versions of this because nothing came out at the time. But I think what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the version that Pollard almost certainly would have put on his tape. So this is going back to 2001, isn't it? So it's not the huge big box sets that have been around over the last 3 or 4 years or perhaps 5 years. It's kind of a single album version of Smile that we're going to consider.
Robert Pollard's Guide to the Late 60s is a Trust the Wizards production. You can find out more at pollard60s.com and on Twitter at pollard60s. If you liked it, then please subscribe and review wherever you get your podcasts. You may also enjoy their other podcast, which you can find at trustthewizards.com. Original music by the Malibu Storks. Kicker of Elves and Chorizo Garbanzo are currently appearing in Waiting for Godot at the Mail Theatre in Leeds.